And here the first interlude finishes with the presence of the angel and with the information concerning John, where the interlude refers to John, where he must prophesy again the things of the future, and he records these things for us. And the description of the future events begins immediately after the second interlude. So the second interlude essentially is the continuation of the first, and it is connected with the conjunction end, and it happens to be a very brief summary of this bittersweet content of the tiny booklet. What's written in this booklet? All that it writes, all these things, bittersweet things, as we said, all these in a form of a very brief letter with great brevity, and recorded in the second interlude. The second interlude makes for one of the most dark readings of this book, and consequently, one of the most difficult pieces to interpret. But of the most important sections of the entire book of the Revelation as well, the content of this interlude, of this section, is mainly eschatological. And it's considered as the prelude of all the things that are about to follow during the trumpeting of the seventh plague. The scene of this unfolding of the first interlude seems to be the area of Jerusalem and its temple. However, this is of a clearly symbolic character, as we will see soon when we continue, without excluding the possibility of a real interpretation at a certain point of this interlude, which once again we will see closely when we reach that point. For example, when it says, there where their Lord was crucified, but this happens to be historical Jerusalem, the city of Jerusalem. But we will see this when we reach that point. Consequently, my friends, the language of this second interlude is symbolic in its greater part, and this is how we must see it. And let's not forget that this page of the book of the Revelation is very nebulous and yet very important and interesting, because it opens the way for the Antichrist and the understanding of his person. And by the grace of God, we are now at chapter 11. And I was given a reed like a measuring rod, saying, rise and measure the temple of God, the altar, and those who worship there, but leave out the courtyard, which is outside the temple, and do not measure it, for it has been given to the nations, to the Gentiles. And they will tread the holy city underfoot for 42 months. And I was given, and this end connects the aforesaid, the first interlude, with the second. The second interlude has two parts. The first part refers to the measuring of the temple, as we saw, and the second part to the action of the two witnesses, the two prophets. These two verses, the first part of this interlude, shows the holy evangelist to be on the earth, but all the other actions seen in this vision, all the things taking place in the area of the vision always, all these things are on the earth. So there's nothing in heaven at this point, but all the images are on the earth. Who's the one who speaks? And he said to me, who's the one speaking to John? Christ. Because a few lines farther down, he uses the phrase, and I will give my two witnesses, in the third verse of this chapter. So Christ is the one speaking. A reed is given to the holy evangelist. As I told you, a reed is something like a measuring rod to measure. When we measure a place, we know the area, the length, the height, the width of what's of its dimensions, or if it's two dimensional or three dimensions, like a flat surface, a field. By measuring, we have access to some information. This acquisition of knowledge is very important, especially in the area of physics. For From the time we are able to measure an object, we have it in our possession, in a way. If we weigh the mass of the sun, and our scientists have accomplished this, we know the weight and the mass of the sun. We have conquered the sun in some way. From the moment we are able to weigh the earth, we have conquered it. In other words, the measurement of an object equates acquisition of that object according to physics, and you may remember this from a lesson in your physics some time ago. So what is the meaning here behind the measurement of the temple? When he took the reed to measure the temple, he received knowledge. He learned something. The holy evangelist learned some things. Consequently, the measurement is the symbol of knowledge, but the initiation into the mysteries of God as well. St. Andrew of Caesarea writes, "We say this reed to be a measure which designates knowledge received accordingly. But the worthiness of the one receiving it, and they become worthy by their good deeds to receive this knowledge from God or from the holy angels. But what is behind this action of St. John to measure the temple, the altar, and the worshipers found in it? This is a symbolic action of the protection of God. I will concentrate on this because this is a focal point. Symbolic action of God's protection, equivalent to the seal of the faithful described by the first interlude after the sixth plague of the sixth seal, there where the angel said, 'Do not allow the four winds loose until we seal the faithful of God.' And the number of those sealed was 144,000. I'm sure you remember this. Now then, there we had a measurement, a numbering and sealing. And even an exact number was given, a symbolic number, obviously. Here we have the same thing, to measure the temple, the altar, and all the faithful worshiping there. This all shows that they are sealed. In other words, they are protected. So measurement here means divine protection. However, we must also seek out the identity of this temple. What or where is this temple? Here are the difficulties of the interpretation, but we will do what we can. At the time when the revelation was written, the temple no longer existed. It was destroyed at 70 AD by Titus, and after him, his son Vespasian. St. Andrew writes on this point, "Some say that the temple of God is the Old Testament, while the outer court, they understand it to be the New Testament. However, we believe that the temple of God is the church." So what is the temple? The church. The altar is the church. So in reality, the temple is the church, and more specifically, the faithful, the believers. And they are projected here with the image of the temple. It is well known that in the New Testament, the faithful, the believers, are called temples of God. First, here in the book of the Revelation, in the third chapter, when Christ sends his epistle to the Bishop of Philadelphia, he finishes as follows. "The one who wins, the victorious, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he will exit no more, and I will write upon him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, of the New Jerusalem." So here's the city, the New Jerusalem, which descends from heaven and out of my God. In other words, the church. Thus, the holy city, the temple, the altar, all these are simply the church. Please hold on to this point that all these things are the church. This is very important. Likewise, St. Paul says, "Do you not know that you are God's temple, and the Spirit of God dwells in you?" He also says this to the Ephesians. Now therefore, you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God. So the faithful grow into a holy temple in the Lord. Holy temple, the faithful, the members of the church, in whom you also are being built together for a dwelling place of God in the Spirit. So then, my friends, the temple is the church. The holy city from heaven is the church, and so on. Since the old temple of Jerusalem does not exist, and it did not exist during the time of the writing of the book of the Revelation, and especially since temples of the living God is a characteristic of the faithful, we must say, along with St. Andrew of Caesarea, that the temple that John was told to measure is the church. Whether we consider the altar of burnt offerings in the yard of the faithful, according to the format of the old temple, we must say that this has to do with the space of the faithful, which is the church and its members. Once again, the measurement of the church is a symbol of protection and salvation during the evil days of the Antichrist. The phrase that says, "and those who worship there," is very interesting, meaning the altar of the burned offerings, the altar where incense was offered, which was inside the temple, and only the priests could enter there, and the archpriest. Outside in the inner yard was the altar where they sacrificed the animals, and all the faithful would concentrate there at the altar of the burnt offerings. Beyond this point was the outer yard, and the faithful could be there if they wished, but this was primarily for the idolaters or the Gentiles who could not cross over into the inner yard. Keep this in mind because it will truly help you to understand this mystery. But they, the faithful, worship there means they worship at the altar of Christ. They are round about the liturgical life, the ones who commune the body and blood of Christ. I underline this consciously. This also reminds us the words of the Lord who said, "Who will be those who will be worshiping there?" 8 times coming, the Lord said to the Samaritan woman, "The hour is coming when you will neither worship the Father on this mountain," what mountain? Gerizim, "nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father, but the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth." So then, this has nothing to do with the temple of Solomon, but this is the true worship of God in spirit and truth from the true faithful. Naturally, only this kind of worshipers will be saved, because they have stood living temples of the true God, who now protects his church with the image of the measurement, the image of the measuring rod. But leave out the outer court, which is outside of the temple, and do not measure it. So the outer yard, and we provided a diagram earlier, the outer yard you will not measure. Let it go. Now pay close attention to this very interesting point. It means that he's commanded not to measure, because this outer yard will not be included in the protection of God. So this outer yard, which is also a part, an area of the church, the holy city, which again is the church, will be tread underfoot by the Gentiles, because they will not be protected by Christ. On the contrary, all the areas that were measured will be protected: the temple, those worshiping at the altar, and the altar. This is odd, strange. Only one half of the church. How is this explained? Please pay attention and you will see. I told you previously that holy city is a title for Jerusalem. Here we see this title many times in the Old Testament, and the New to refer to Jerusalem as the holy city. What is the meaning, however? It appears that the inner area of the church will remain untrodden and protected from the attacks of the Antichrist. The outer area of the church will be trodden. The inner part, the inner area of the church, is made up by the faithful, by those who always remain faithful regardless of the ethically decomposed world around them. They encircle the altar and they prove to be true worshipers of God. The outer shell of the church, the outer yard, as we called it earlier, are all those so-called Christians who wish to be called Christians. They're the Christians of heresy, the lukewarm Christians, and everything that relates to the relationship of the church and the world with the meaning of a secularized church. This will not maintain the protection of God, and it will be trodden by the nations. This worldly Christianity, this secularized church, the outer yard, the surface Christians will not be protected by Christ and will be trodden by the Gentiles or the people who do not have any relation with the church. How much this Christianity is disapproved and spurned by Christ, this becomes obvious from this mandate not to be counted in the measurement for this space of the church to be left out of the measurement of John. And in order to better understand this subject, let's listen, my friends, to the ever-memorable Father Justin Popovich and what he writes in his book, Men and Godmen. And I read from page 131. Only with its God-human power, Christianity is the salt of the earth, salt that preserves men not to be corrupt by sin and evil. What is this salt? The God-man Jesus, quote unquote. When we begin to say that Christ is a philosopher, a social reformer, or a sociologist, and something similar was printed by one of the Athenian newspapers, if you can call them that, they were commenting on the anecdote or the funny fable. And what was this funny fable? That Jesus walked on the water. Did you hear this anecdote? That Jesus walked on the waves of the sea? You see, if you don't believe that Jesus is the God-man, perfect God and perfect man, then you are left with a saltless, tasteless Christianity. And when Christianity becomes mixed up with a number of humanisms, then it turns into foolishness. It becomes salt without saltiness, which according to the most true word of the Savior, it is totally useless but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. Let us know that every attempt and every experiment to equate or to relate Christianity with the spirit of this world takes away from Christianity that special quality, that special value, which makes it the only God-human religion of the world. We have many of these attempts throughout the centuries. And there have been some loud voices and movements of some historical times, and these will always exist where different interests and political parties wish to align themselves and their philosophies with Christianity to propagate their agenda. No, my friends, we don't need the confirmation and the compliance of the God-man Christ towards the spirit of the times, but confirmation and compliance of the spirit of the times towards the spirit of eternity of Christ, of the God-humanity of Christ. This is the true and foremost mission of the Church of Christ in the world, of the Orthodox and Apostolic Church. Only this way the Church will be able to preserve the life-giving and irreplaceable personality of the God-human Christ. In other words, this tremendous worth in all the worlds, the visible and the invisible, and the ones to come. Because this Christ is the supreme treasure and the salt of all measures and of all things. So we cannot lower Christianity to humanistic levels. I hope you understand all this. Unfortunately, my friends, we see the fruits of this offense not only in Europe, but even here in our pitiful and lowly country of Greece. We see it so clearly. It is so overt. We chase away Christ and seek out the devil, something terrible in our days. And we seek to replace him with a rationalism and the format of a humanistic state. What will be the result of all this? A general bankruptcy in all the sectors of our life. And you see it, and you will see it. Today, the church is not considered necessary, but rather it serves as a hindrance as far as our humanistic and political orientations are concerned. For this reason, we are ostracizing the church, since we have done our best to slander it every way possible. Essentially, the church, the quality of the church accepted by most people, the way they wish the church to be, this cannot be a church that saves people. This type of church does not save people. The church that was surveyed and measured is the temple, who are the faithful, who worship, and so on. This church is for the most part under persecution. Consequently, the church is called upon to fight its battles against the deserters and the deniers, and this when it descends to her catacombs. And it will descend, not only as a matter of speech. This way, the words spoken to us by the unmistakable mouth of Christ will come to pass about the church which is measured and encircled by the protection of God. And the gates of Hades will not overcome it. As far as this other church, the one outside, the one of the outer yard that we talked about, consisting of lukewarm, uninformed Christians who are ready to compromise at any moment with the slightest exchange. They're ready to sell out to the world and to the Caesars. This church will be stepped upon by the nations. In other words, it will be in the jurisdiction of the godless and the unbelievers. And these people need such a church for their many self-interests. For it has been given to the nations, and they will tread the holy city underfoot for 42 months. What is the explanation behind this? During the last days, my friends, the Antichrist will be squeezing and provoking these indecisive and compromising and unstable Christians who will go back and forth for 42 months for 3.5 years. Naturally, he will be pressuring the true Christians as well. The difference is that the true Christians will be steadfast. They will keep the faith because they will have the divine protection. While these unstable and compromising Christians will be victimized by the demands of the Antichrist. For the faithful, the words of the Lord will find their validity. Do not be afraid of those who are able to kill the body, but have no power to kill the soul. This is expressed very nicely by St. Andrew of Caesarea. To give the holy city to be stepped by the nations for 42 months, this I believe it to be during the presence of the Antichrist, where for 3.5 years the faithful and the seasoned Christians will be trodden and persecuted. This time of 3.5 years can also be taken literally, but even symbolically, which means a very long period of time. But not very long, because it is 1/2 of 7, which 7 is the symbol of fullness. But this 3.5 means a brief time which shows the shortening of the days, and this for the sake of the faithful. The Lord said, and unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days will be made short. They'll be shortened. This also has its literal interpretation, which we will see at that specific point and a verse. In any event, my friends, the conclusions from the first and the second interlude are obvious. The believers will be persecuted, but they will have the divine protection. Whichever Christian persuasion has become saltless, without salt, has lost its saltness, this will be trodden under the foot of the Antichrist, and it will be definitely and permanently lost because it lacks God's protection. From this we see that we are of great need of constant vigilance. That's why the Orthodox spirit and our continued perseverance and allegiance to it, my friends, despite the persecution, let's not forget it, the true Orthodox spirit will be our salvation.